This is Studio 395, a production of the Department of History at James Madison University in its Historical Research Methods course, History 395. Hi, I'm Luke Dunn, a junior history major. I'm speaking today with Thomas Weber, a junior history major and author of the paper, The Press During Vietnam, How the Media in the Years of and Up to the Tet Offensive Changed Public Perception. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So to jump right in, let's say you said that the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese casualties were quickly and easily replaced, which I thought was an interesting way to say it. Why so? What was the motive for these soldiers fighting for Vietnam?
So not so much the North Vietnamese army, I would say, that the soldiers of the North Vietnamese army were replaced in the same fashion as any army is replaced. But especially for the Viet Cong, the way that the Marines encountered the Viet Cong. So the Viet Cong, just a little bit of backstory, the Viet Cong were the guerrilla fighters of encountered by U.S. forces in South Vietnam during the Vietnam War. They blended in very, very well with the local populations because they were the local population. I think back to incidents like the Cam Ne incident in 1965, where a detachment of Marines was sent to the village of Cam Ne to conduct a search for weapons, and they found nothing. Yet they still lit the village on fire on recording with flamethrowers and Zippo lighters. And you want the question of how are they quickly and easily replaced? Well, when the United States is doing things like this to people, it inspires more people to this cause. Furthermore, the basis of the Viet Cong rebellion comes from the history of Vietnam itself. When the French exited Vietnam in 1954, the part of the Geneva Accords that were reached was that the North Vietnamese would remove all of their troops from South Vietnam during the partition. They would remove all their troops from South Vietnam. However, when the French left and the United States had refused to go over there at this point in history, the North Vietnamese just said, no, we're not going to. And so these remnant troops became the basis of Viet Cong forces. So there was already a strong presence, at least thousands to maybe 10,000 or more communist troops already present in South Vietnam before the United States even got there. And so these troops trained and taught people communist rhetoric, communist beliefs, and so it led to this underlying communist, I don't want to call it favoring, but underlying group of communists present.
Sympathy
is a good word. Yes, thank you. In South Vietnam, and so whenever. Not only was there sympathy, but when like I said, when villages would be burned or family members killed, it would only inspire more South Vietnamese to support the Viet Cong.
Right. So similarly to the Soviet-Afghan War and Vietnam War and the Soviet-Afghan War, parallels of each other with the switching sides pretty much. Mm-hmm. The Soviets backed the opponents of the United States, as one does in the Cold War. Did the U.S. government know that they were the Viet Cong was being supported by the Soviets and other communist countries? If they did, why did they underestimate their opponents?
So in the years leading up to the Tet Offensive, even before the Tet Offensive in 1968 is really my key example of intelligence failure by the United States and where things really started. The intelligence community and the government really started to go or realized they had an issue. U.S. intelligence at this point was as strong as any of the superpowers, but the United States suffered from it had an ego. It was a little bit of arrogance. I bring up the Tet Offensive example because months before the Tet Offensive, we collected documents. Soldiers on the ground collected documents detailing what was going to happen, that there was going to be a coordinated, large-scale, sweeping attack across South Vietnam on key strategic points, and it was going to be a hectic and brutal fight. But the intelligence community rejected this. It said that the higher ups and the of both the government, intelligence community, the military, all obviously not all of them were completely dismissive of it, but largely that was the idea that there's no way that the Vietnamese could launch an attack of this scale. It's not possible. And so that kind of mindset was present even much before the Tet Offensive. And so I think, yes, to an extent, the United States government suspected and knew, but I would not, I don't think I could rightfully say that they, it wouldn't be fair to say that they necessarily knew. They didn't know the Soviets were backing them, but this American arrogance that it'll all work out, that we had things under control, led to them underestimating the Viet Cong.
Right, right. One thing I found particularly interesting was the suppression of Buddhists in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And when you think about Buddhism, you think about an incredibly peaceful religion with meditation and understanding. Why were they suppressed in Vietnam? Because you get a visceral feeling when you see someone set themselves on fire like the monk did. Why do you think that practice was so effective?
The self-immolation?
Yes.
So why was the self-immolation so effective, and why were they being suppressed? So the South Vietnamese government at the time, so the Buddhist crisis happened in the years of 1960, or began the year 1963, and didn't really settle itself until the early 70s. Largely, South Vietnam was a Christian country. And the President Ngo Dinh Diem at the time, his military began enforcing for reasons that are largely still speculation, began enforcing laws that directly, they weren't written to prosecute the Buddhist people, but I think back to this, the example I use in my research paper was this antiquated law about not displaying any other flag than the South Vietnamese flag on a certain day. It was a Buddhist day of worship, and they had flags out. And this is how the crisis, quote unquote, began, where the military began cracking down on this and violently attacking people, the worshipers, and people displaying these flags. And so, I think largely it comes the suppression. I think comes from Diem's both his own faith and his attempt to really collect his strength in a country that was beginning to lose its strength, because at this point, United States is not, it has, during the Buddhist crisis, there are troops over as advisors, but it's not truly in immense numbers yet. It's not a huge ground force. Diem is being left to his quote-unquote own devices, not to use that term again, but he's being left to manage it himself. And he is slightly inept at this, as this is his method of control. He's beginning to turn towards what some viewed as authoritarianism. So that's largely why they were suppressed, basically, of the failure of Diem as a president, and partially his own faith, but largely it was a method of control. He was trying to strengthen his base, his look, I should say, to be the strong leader they needed during the war effort. But it ended up, I will get there, but at the end of the Buddhist crisis, it actually led to his ousting and his assassination.
Right.
But as for the self-immolation,
I feel like it just gets people talking about it, just seeing that.
And so what was also so moving about it is that reports from the people who were there said that the man, I his name was Duke, I think it was Trinh Duc, he was an older man, I think he was in his 50s, and he sat there and lit himself on fire and uttered no sound, didn't move, no reaction. And to the people on the ground seeing this, it was this immense, not only horrifying thing, but this immense sign of belief in a cause. And so he wasn't actually the only monk that did it. There were, I think, quite a few, 10, 20 plus, I'm not quite sure the number, maybe not 20, I think 20 might be hyperbole, but there was quite a few more Vietnamese monks who did this. This began...
That's not even counting the people in the United States that did it too.
Right, and so that actually was where I was going next. There were quite a few Buddhist monks that did it, and it became a shocking thing there. But in the United States, this became... To be able to see this, man burning, right? This you're think from this perspective of a average United States citizen, right? You're being told that things are going swimmingly in Vietnam, that the DM's got it under control, and then you see a photo in magazines of a man not reacting to being on fire. It was shocking, and it inspired many to follow in their footsteps. I think of the most famous was Norman Morrison, who lit himself on fire outside the office of McNamara, outside the Pentagon, and was moments away from immolating his daughter with him, his 11-month-old daughter. But they were able to get him to release his baby before he went up fully in flames. And that's only the most famous. There was Alice Hers before him, was an 86-year-old woman who was doing it as in protest of the war. There was further, some Catholics saw it as a solidarity thing, but largely, interestingly enough, was the Quakers, another peaceful, peace-centered religion in the United States, was moved by this. And so I think to wrap it up in a nice bow, I think that immolation was a moving thing to United States citizens because there had been war protests, but no one genuinely, there had been suicide protests, but no, not at this scale. The growing media presence, just like today, where media blows everything up, the smallest thing is it becomes crazy news. Obviously, this was not, it was no small thing, but it was everywhere.
Right.
I think it was just a shocking and inspiring thing to be to a country that hadn't seen it before.
And just to conclude, why was television so important? I guess this segues from what you were just talking about, but why was television so important when it came to shaping public opinion?
So up until this point in American history, the news came from the government. The press didn't take very hardline stances on things. It was very, the government says this, or the military is reporting this, right? Especially during World War II, it was very, this is what's going on with our boys over there. They're sticking it to Jerry, right? And they would report losses as a positive thing. You know, it's like, oh, well, we're regrouping, right? We're regrouping and we're going to go back. During even the early years of Vietnam, it was similar. But television, the development of color television, started showing people the horrors of war. You know, for the first time, the recordings of war were done by reporters on the ground with teams of news teams instead of film men sent over to capture something and produce an image. They were there to report the news, and they captured people dying and burning and awful mutilations. I think of the execution of the Viet Cong officer, the famous photo of the South Vietnamese police chief shooting the man in the head. But that was recorded. That was recorded and shown. It, not only was it the famous photo, but that's a screenshot from a video recording. And so color television, for the first time, American citizens could see war and the horrors of war, what it was like to experience war, in their living rooms, and this shocked and disgusted a lot of people, and they could see, their brother or their father or their cousin, their friends, what they were going through. It was no longer this reverent, we're doing the right thing. They received no true, especially in the later years of war, no true methods or signs of progress, no indications that they were fighting for anything, or that we were fighting for anything in Vietnam, even though the United States government kept reporting on television, oh, like, things are great, we're doing fine, we're winning the Tet Offensive, when you're seeing in color the bodies of fallen Americans for the first time ever, it's a shocking thing. And it becomes this idea of the American public can't see what progress is being made, the little progress that was being made, and it really undermined the war effort. I would argue that the expansion of television and media on television really undermined the war effort, and I would argue that it furthered the end of the Vietnam War and the loss of it.
Right. So, thank you, Tom. This was very interesting.
Thank you for
having had me. Known nothing about the Vietnam War otherwise, other than from reading your paper, so it was pretty enlightening personally for me. So,
thank you for listening to Studio 395. For interviews on a wide range of historical topics and subscriptions to our podcast are available on our show page at sites.lib.jmu.edu/studio395. To learn about the history major at James Madison University, please visit www.jmu.edu/history.